Hi there, I'm Todd Fraser with another ANZIC CTG podcast from the 19th annual CTG meeting in the beautiful Noosa Heads in Queensland, Australia. Joining me on this episode is Winston Chung from the Sydney University Medical School to discuss two proposed studies, both looking at accreditation for key skills, an issue that's quite close to my heart. Winston, welcome.
Thank you, Todd.
In the first study that you're looking at, you're looking at CVC credentialing. What's the clinical need for a program like this, do you think?
Yes, my personal feeling is we don't do CVC credentialing very well in Australia. And I think when problems occur with central line insertion, we have to be able to say not only to the coroner, to a credentialing agency, but also especially to our patients and our families, that what we are doing is best practice. And I think we have to say that we are doing the best that we can in terms of training, in terms of process, but it also in terms of supervision. And it's the one thing I don't think we do very, very well in Australia.
Yeah. So tell us about the package that you're trying to implement about that credentialing. How do you do it?
Yeah, so our package is based essentially on the most high-risk activity that we take every day, which is driving a motor car. And we figured that if a credentialing process exists and that is acceptable to the public in the use of credentialing for motor vehicles, then that would also be acceptable to the public for the credentialing of central lines. And the problem at the moment is that there are several credentialing programs around, but a lot of them are very, very onerous. And all of them take into account patient safety, but they don't take into account actually the needs of the organisation. And so the problem is getting a credentialing system that takes into account all those things, the needs of novice people training, but also the experts. Patient safety has to be paramount, but it can't be so onerous that it paralyzes an organization. So we've developed a system based on the driver's license accreditation system, where everybody coming to an ICU is regarded as a learner. And then from a learner, you progress to a provisional stage. As a learner, you must do every central line supervised and must continue to be directly supervised for every line insertion. But as a once you get your provisional P plate, you can, just like you can drive a motor car unsupervised, you can insert a central line unsupervised. And then when you become when you develop full accreditation, then you can actually be an assessor and supervise other people in this insertion of their lines. But the key point is getting people from the learner phase to the provisional driver's license phase. So our new system, which we've started at Concord and we're piloting, along with this evaluation study, essentially learners go through the phase and have to do four things. The first thing they have to do is they have to read the state policy on central line insertion, which is a few pages. The second thing they have to do is they have to go through a teaching online component, which was actually developed by New South Wales Health about 7 or 8 years ago as part of their CLAB ICU infection control program.
Yep.
But it was a very good program, and it was a very good online learning tool, and we decided not to reinvent the wheel, so we decided to use that. So they have to sit that, and the advantage of that is that there's actually a small test at the end, which you actually can't pass unless you know something about central line insertion or you've done the material in the course.
Yep.
And then the third part is you have to read our local guidelines, which is a couple pages long. And then the fourth part is we've added an ultrasound component where everyone has to sit an ultrasound teaching session, and our intensivists and anaesthetists at Concord provide that. Once they've done all that, they still have to do all their lines supervised, but when they are ready, they can sit their practical driver's license test.
Yep.
And all that is they have to be deemed to be competent by an assessor in the insertion of a line at each various site. So you get a P plate for femoral line, you get a P plate for subclavian line, you get a P plate for IJ.
So how do you define what competence is in that framework?
So we've used a pragmatic rule in that the assessor has to believe that they would allow that person to insert a central line in their loved one. So that's the litmus test for what we define as competency. If an assessor comes along and says, I'm happy for you to insert that in one of my kids or one of my family members, then we deem that as being competency to get provisional accreditation to insert central lines unsupervised.
Now, you referred to the impact on the institution. What were you referring to then?
Well, The current New South Wales framework that we have is very onerous. So the New South Wales framework, which was developed by CEC, which we're supposed to be using, tells operators that they need to watch one being done, then they have to do three supervised, at the same time they have to go through a teaching program, and then they have to perform five unsupervised insertions before they get their accreditation. And the problem with that one size fits all is that we may have a registrar from overseas or who is a trained anaesthetist or trained intensivist who's done hundreds or thousands of lines, and they don't need to go through a program such as that. And at the opposite end of the spectrum, we may have a first-year trainee who's never done a line before, who actually may need more lines or more supervision. So we don't think the one-size-fits-all. We've tried using it, and to date, we actually haven't had anyone pass the credentialing process because the credentialing process falls away midway through.
Why is that?
I think it's because of fatigue, and I think it's because people don't see value in the current credentialing program. Mm. And so I think if people are going to adopt a training program, people need to see value in it. And it's an important issue that we have to address, both in terms of training but also in terms of retraining in various aspects of ICU.
So the bigger picture here is that this has got to extend across a system, doesn't it? Because, yep, as you say, people move between different institutions. Yep. So how do you propose that they're going to take that with them?
Yeah, so what we have is a logbook. So we've developed a logbook, and we've developed this program in collaboration with both the anaesthetists and also emergency physicians at our institution, as well as the quality and safety division of our institution. And so what we're planning on doing and what we've started is that all the registrars in our hospital will get this logbook and undergo this program regardless of where they are in the hospital, whether they be in ED, anaesthetics or the ICU. And they keep a logbook of all the lines which they've inserted. The main thing that the logbook records is if there have been any adverse events as a result resulting from their line insertion. Mm-hmm. And the study that we have introduced as part of this program will email consenting participants every 3 to 6 months or telephone them and essentially ask them how many lines they've put in and what adverse events have occurred. And the whole point of the study is to develop a baseline adverse event rate for the program, so that if an accreditation agency asks us why have we used this program, we can say, well, our adverse event rate is X.
Yep.
And until someone comes up with an accreditation process that has a better adverse event rate, this is the program that we're going to stick with.
So what do you think the barriers to implementing this are going to be?
The main barrier from point of view is you need someone to actually to drive it and to actually implement it, but implementation is relatively easy. The biggest barrier in terms of the actual study is having someone follow up, or the registrars. We hope to recruit as many registrars as we can at our institution over the next 3 years and follow them up until they complete their fellowship. But that means following up probably 50 registrars by the three-year mark, two or three times a year, which we don't think is onerous, and so and especially if it's by email. So we don't think it's that onerous, but you still need someone to do that. Mm. But in terms of barriers to implementation, the biggest barrier is probably going to be expertise in terms of ultrasound. We've deliberately put that in because ultrasound is now considered standard of care. And so for hospitals to actually introduce this, they will need someone at that hospital who's prepared to teach and train people in ultrasound-guided technique.
The inevitable question that comes up with those sorts of things is how this interfaces with the colleges. Have you dealt with that issue?
We haven't yet. Before we did this, we did a literature search looking at what the evidence was, but we also looked at all the college guidelines. The College of Intensive Care and Emergency Medicine currently have no guidelines on central line insertion. The College of Anaesthetists only have a volume of practice guideline, and so it's recommended that their trainees perform 40 central lines during their training, but doesn't stipulate how they do them and how many of them have to be supervised. So we would imagine that this would be incorporated into college guidelines at some stage if they thought it was valuable. But obviously we want to evaluate it first, because if it doesn't work, or if it's overly onerous, then there's no point incorporating it.
Do you have any idea what the exposure of the average trainee is to this sort of procedure?
Anecdotally, it's low. So for our accreditation process to actually get full accreditation, we've put down you need a minimum of 50 insertions throughout your training. And that's based on one small paper published back in 1986, which showed that operators who had performed more than 50 had less complications, but a small study. We're probably looking at 40 as the overall target for full accreditation, because that's what's currently in the ANSCO guidelines. But even the anaesthetists admit that it would be very unlikely in this day and age that an anaesthetic trainee would do 40 lines during their training, and certainly most ED trainees would not get 40 lines. So to actually get full accreditation in our program, you either have to complete 50 or maybe 40 lines. But we've also put down a provision that once you get your fellowship, you have automatic accreditation, with the view that the justification is that Medicare currently will pay a rebate if you have a fellowship for central lines, and if it's good enough for Medicare, we think it's good enough for the public.
What's the feedback been from the CTG group on the proposal?
Well, I haven't actually spoken to them yet.
Oh,
okay. So I'm speaking to them this afternoon. And so that was the reason for bringing it to the CTG, was to see whether people thought we were going down the right path, whether this was a concept worth pursuing, and also to see whether there was interest in taking on this this proposal at their own institutions and taking part in the evaluation study.
So the second study that you're proposing is looking at BLS accreditation. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so this started because we went through mini accreditation last year, and I was tasked with the job of trying to credential all the people who had fallen away in terms of their basic life support accreditation at the hospital, and it was an onerous task. At the end of it all, we said that we discussed it, and we said that there has got to be a better way of doing this. And so we came up with the concept of having a randomised controlled trial. At the moment, the standard of care for accreditation is that basic life support is supposed to be taught or retaught annually, and that's recommended by the Australian Resuscitation Council at the moment. It's also recommended by the College of GPs, but none of the actual learned groups actually have a specific recommendation on that. But given that, and given that there's actually currently a mandate in Standard 9 of our of the Australian quality guidelines, basic life support is now mandated that we be performed annually. And what we're proposing is a three-armed randomised control study, the first arm being standard of care at the moment, or standard of practice, which is annual compulsory accreditation. The second arm being 4 yearly but compulsory accreditation, and the fifth arm being purely voluntary accreditation, where a person will undertake training whenever they feel like it, how often or how little they feel like undergoing it. The primary outcome measure will be the number of staff who actually pass a competency test in year five, and that's conducted by a blinded assessor who will make an appointment to see the staff member at very short notice and assess them on their competency in the fifth year of the study.
So in that construct, the first two arms will be assessed about a year after they last did the course. Is the inference that the repetition is making a difference? Or
yeah,
not?
No. So the everyone will be assessed only in the fifth year. The first two arms, the first arm, they undergo annual training and then assessed in the fifth year. The second arm, they undergo training in the first year, don't have any training for 3 years, and then just have a test conducted in the fifth year.
Right.
With the view, we want to see whether the knowledge which they gained in that first year is retained for 4 years, and whether their pass rates are the same as a person who has annual accreditation in the fifth year.
Yep.
Now, the issues with that, we know that the studies show that knowledge decays with time, and especially skills tend to decay more than knowledge. And we know that for ALS training, it's dependent on the initial training of the person. It's dependent on the environment which people work in, but it tends to decay around about the 6 to 12 month mark. So what we're proposing is we're recruiting doctors and specialist doctors who will be around in 5 years' time to undergo the test. We're excluding doctors who are involved with critical care, such as emergency physicians, anaesthetists, intensivists, and we're also excluding the cardiologists on the assumption that they probably perform more resuscitation or basic life support than the others. But we're concentrating on a group who will be around in 5 years' time who don't have a lot of exposure to basic life support normally, to see whether it's essentially a non-inferiority study. So we want to see whether the second and third arms are actually non-inferior to the first arm. And the reason being is that if they are non-inferior, then we stand to actually gain in terms of reduced workloads for educational staff and reduced workloads for staff having to undergo annual accreditation.
Have you got a gut feel about what you'll find?
My gut feel is that I think voluntary accreditation will be similar to doing it annually, because I think people will look at their own learning needs and will undergo accreditation when they feel they need to. I think 4-yearly accreditation, I think the knowledge decay will be too great, especially if people don't have practice. So I feel that that's not going to be inferior. I feel that that will be inferior. I don't think we'll prove non-inferiority with that. My gut feeling is that the voluntary one will be non-inferior to standard practice.
Best of luck with it, Winston. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Todd.
Thanks for joining me again on this ANZIC CTG podcast. For more episodes, please check out my blog at www.essentialcriticalcare.com.